It's the third and final day for the Supreme Court to hear arguments about health care reform.
What does the court think, and what do doctors think?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Wednesday, March 28th.
Coming up, how important is sleep?
And why Brits are blaming the Queen for the bad economy.
It's all coming up right here on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We have reached the final day of arguments at the Supreme Court on President Obama's health care overhaul. And the big news so far is that the key swing vote on the court, that would be Justice Anthony Kennedy, might not be so swing. Here's what he said yesterday about the part of the law that would require people to buy health insurance.
And here the government is saying that the federal government has a duty to tell the individual citizen that it must act. And that is different from what we have in previous cases.
Well,
that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way.
A very fundamental way. And that's the line that's got supporters of the health care law concerned. Well, today, the justices will look at whether, if the court strikes down the individual mandate, the other parts of the law can remain in place. Healthcare economist Brad Herring of Johns Hopkins University says the problem with taking the individual mandate out is this.
Only the people who are older with chronic health conditions would purchase health insurance. Insurers would anticipate this, have to elevate the premiums in order to cover their costs. But then in turn, elevating the premium means that some of the younger, healthier people leave the pool, and this leads to what many have called death spiral.
Now, it's not clear that the individual mandate will be thrown out, but perhaps we'll get some more clues on that from the justices today.
That's right, Jeremy. Today is the final day the Supreme Court will hear arguments about the legality of the Obama administration's health care reform. Michael Burgess is a Republican congressman from Texas and a doctor. He's been an outspoken critic of the Affordable Care Act, and he joins me now. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning. Glad to be with you this morning.
Congressman, you have come out against the Affordable Care Act and have said that the U.S. can't withstand the costs of the law. Can we afford to do nothing, though? We've been hearing a lot about how health care costs have skyrocketed in the past 10 years and are sort of spiraling out of control.
Well, the fact is we were lied to about how much this law would cost. But here's the deal. We could have accomplished some of the same things by taking very incremental but very real steps, perhaps a series of 5, 7, or 9 pieces of legislation that could have been done over this past 2 years, and it would not have changed some of the fundamental nature of the relationship between the federal government and the American people, as Justice Kennedy brought up yesterday, and it wouldn't have destroyed the profession of medicine. So I think there were some possibilities for some big wins there. Unfortunately, politics intervened 2 years ago, and no one was interested in working together. And we are where we are, and it's a pretty big mess.
There are a lot of people who have gotten or who will get insurance under the Affordable Care Act. If the law is overturned, what about the uninsured?
Well, you know, when you listen to the arguments yesterday at the Supreme Court, they talked about, well, the uninsured are driving our costs up so much. That's nonsense. The big cost driver is the fact that Medicare and Medicaid are underfunded because the government does not pay its way on those programs that it already does. Look, we all know in the Medicaid system today, they underpay physicians so poorly that Medicaid patients have a hard time getting in to actually see someone. So what do? They go to the emergency room. Yes, they go there with a card in hand that shows they have coverage, but they're still not accessing cost-effective care, and it still drives up cost to the system significantly.
In order to control the healthcare costs, what would be a better solution, in your opinion?
Well, remember, one size is not going to fit everyone. I do a health savings account. I've done one for years. I think that is a very reasonable way to go about for people who are not on Medicare, who are entering the working world. Sure, I think everyone ought to have a catastrophic policy that covers them for those never events that we all never want to think about, but which we all know we're at risk for daily. But I don't think the government has a role in requiring that.
Congressman Michael Burgess is a Republican from Texas, and he is also a doctor. Congressman, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we've heard from a congressman, we've heard from a justice, we've heard from a healthcare expert. Now, what about doctors? What do they think about healthcare reform? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
I spoke with 3 doctors in different parts of the country. Dr. Jane Orient is from Tucson, Arizona. I'm a physician and executive director of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons.
She sees the new health care reforms as the biggest government expansion since the New Deal.
Already, it's created 2 million words worth of new regulations, which will probably make it increasingly difficult or impossible for small practices to continue just because they can't bear this great overhead of compliance costs.
In Albany, New York, Dr. Andrew Coates is an internist and president-elect of Physicians for a National Health Program. Coates says the Affordable Care Act does not keep a lid on prices and favors insurers.
For this reform to hand $447 billion over to the private health insurance industry to subsidize premiums of working people who otherwise couldn't afford health insurance is in many ways a bailout of the industry.
Finally, from Minnetonka, Minnesota, Dr. Ernest Swihard supports the new law. He's a behavioral pediatrician whose patients need mental health insurance.
I see lots of patients coming in who can't afford to see me because they don't have coverage.
Some of his young patients can only afford to see him because the new health care law allows parents to keep their kids on their insurance policies longer. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Now, from the reigning court to a reigning lady over in the UK, a lot of worries the country is sliding back into recession. And, Jeremy, the Brits are fingering a surprising culprit. The Queen.
Really?
They're blaming the Queen for the bad economy.
Yeah, it seems this year's Diamond Jubilee, which celebrates her 60th year on the throne, could be a bad thing for the economy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains why the country is blaming it on the rain.
The royal festivities will reach a peak in June. There's a public holiday with parades and street parties. But the governor of the Bank of England has poured cold water over the proceedings. He's grumbling about the loss of worker productivity during the celebrations. He says it could tip Britain back into recession. Howard Archer of IHS Global Insight agrees, but he says you can't blame Her Majesty for the downturn.
The problem is that the UK economy is struggling and it's probably growing modestly, but not by much. And so it takes very little to cause the economy to either stagnate or even slip back into recession.
Some hope the Jubilee itself will raise spirits and actually give a boost to the British economy. But that's not what happened last year with the royal wedding. The governor of the Bank of England says that hit productivity as workers stayed home and partied. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, speaking of royalty taking some heat, a pair of white silk heels that are thought to have been owned by Marie Antoinette sold at auction in France. And guess how much they fetched?
I don't know. I'm never good at these auction things because I would never pay any money for these items. But go ahead. Tell me. What
$55,000.
Wow.
Yeah, $55,000. The shoes were decorated with the tricolor flag, which is the symbol of the French Revolution. And it's estimated Marie Antoinette owned 500 pairs of shoes.
Wow. And so probably a lot more money is still left to come in. I wonder who gets that money.
Yeah, I don't know.
The auction house, I guess.
You should save your shoes, I guess, is the takeaway here.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Well, it is one step forward, one step back today for the housing market. The Mortgage Bankers Association says applications for home mortgages were up 3.3% last week, while demand for refinancing dropped for the sixth straight week. For more on this and to explain it, let's bring in our regular Wednesday guest, Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. Good morning.
Hey, Jeremy.
So what does all this mean for the housing market?
Yes, yeah, so the fun part with housing data is it's never a clear picture.
Right.
And there's always some good data points and then some bad ones come out. So it's still a little bit muddy, but I'll tell you what I found interesting. We're seeing some really positive sales data and commentary from some of the largest home builders in the country. Hmm. Toll Brothers most recently talked about this being the strongest spring in 5 years. And we're also seeing sales up. Companies like Hovnanian saying up 30%, Lennar up 33%. So there is definitely some strength in some areas of the country in new home sales, and that's important because that's definitely one of the more leading data points when you look at all the various things that we follow with housing.
But how do you square that with like the data that we got this week that home prices still were falling in January?
You know, it's interesting. You can't you can't really square it because a new home is different than an existing home. And so, you know, I don't know that this means you're in for the fabled housing bottom that everyone's been calling for 5 years. But, you know, again, it's another sign of strength. I'll give you one market in particular. We're hearing that in Phoenix, which was really a horrendous real estate market, originally you had a situation where they had 14 to 16 months worth of supply. Now it's more like a more normal 4 to 6 months or in that range. So I think it's, again, a local story, but I think it bears watching because some of the data is really starting to turn up.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The maker of BlackBerry, Research in Motion, reports earnings tomorrow. And Marketplace's Jennifer Collins tells us analysts are still waiting to see if the company can keep up with competitors like Apple and Google.
Research in Motion is at a make-or-break moment. Laura DiDio is an analyst with ITIC.
RIM is in the exact position Indiana Jones was in ahead of that giant boulder. They're really in danger of just being flattened by the competition.
Analysts expect the company to barely hit the low end of sales forecasts. A RIM tablet hasn't taken off, and BlackBerry's been losing share of the business market as many companies offer employees iPhones or Android devices.
When your competitors are Apple and Google, you can't afford even the tiniest misstep, and they've had several.
Carl Howe, Yankee Group VP of Research, says just like a certain archaeologist, BlackBerry may not be doomed yet.
One of the things we still hear from consumers is that these are some of the best devices for doing things like making phone calls, something we tend to lose track of in today's touch-based environment.
Howe says things could improve when BlackBerry releases a new line of smartphones later this year. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report on extreme weather this morning. The report estimates the effects of climate change will cost countries $20 trillion a year by the year 2100. Among the groups watching this report, the insurance industry. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
The new report will help suss out the relationship between climate change and extreme weather events, things like droughts, tornadoes, and flooding, which are big deals if you're an insurer. Lyndeen Patton is with insurance company Zurich Financial Services.
Effects of climate change can certainly impact our entire portfolio.
I.e., they can cost a lot of money. Scientific predictions can also help insurers figure out what to cover and for how much. But the insurance companies aren't the only ones who could feel the pinch of more weather disasters.
This hits all of our pocketbooks.
Cynthia McHale is head of the insurance program at the nonprofit coalition Ceres.
Because if private insurance won't cover extreme weather damages to homes and businesses. In fact, taxpayers are on the hook.
Why? Well, here in the U.S., many insurance programs are backed by federal or state governments, especially in places that private insurance companies don't want to cover the weather risks. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
And now the global perspective on business and economics. The European Central Bank said today that credit was tight for businesses this month, in spite of efforts to get banks lending again. And yesterday, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said the European Union would need to increase the amount of money in its bailout fund to more than $1 trillion. BBC economics correspondent Mark Gregory joins me now. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So, Mark, there are already plans in place for a European rescue fund worth more than $900 billion. So basically what the organization is saying is that is not enough?
That's exactly what they are saying. I mean, their argument is that to really restore the confidence of the financial markets, you need this enormous bailout fund of $1.3 trillion or thereabouts. And that's going to give them the confidence. And then, if you like, the Eurozone can get back to worrying about other things, which is restoring growth.
Right. Well, but any increase in the lending capacity of the Eurozone's bailout funds needs Germany to play ball. And they have expressed some doubts in that area. Do you think they will play ball?
Well, that certainly is the issue. Almost everybody in this debate, apart from Germany, would like to see a larger bailout fund. Germany, until now, has resisted that very, very strongly, although earlier this week, on Monday, in fact, they did announce some kind of concession, but nothing like the kind of movement to the sorts of figures that the OECD and a lot of the other players in this game would like to see.
If the bailout fund does get bigger, is there a concern that countries like Greece might feel like they could pull back on some of the reforms and austerity measures?
Well, underlyingly, this is one of the concerns of Germany, that if there is this large amounts of rescue money sloshing about, then the pressure is off. The contrary view is that you need, if you like, to get the fear out the way, and then people can get on with the process of actually restructuring.
The BBC economics correspondent, Mark Gregory. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, now to something that we can all relate to, sleep, and whether we're getting enough of it. Stacey, do you feel like you're getting enough sleep?
I never feel like I'm getting enough sleep.
Yeah, neither do I. Well, we are not alone. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus has been burning the midnight oil, researching this topic, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it sounds like we're not getting enough sleep, David.
Oh, big time, Jeremy. If you talk to our friends at the Centers for Disease Control, about 75 million Americans, that's more than a quarter of the population, say they don't get enough shut-eye. About 30 million say they have chronic insomnia. Hmm. Now, the CDC says that can have health ramifications. It can lead to diabetes, heart disease, obesity, depression, and it can take an economic toll. Basically, all that lost productivity due to lack of sleep saps the economy about $63 billion a year.
Okay, so why aren't we getting that 8 hours?
Well, in part because of all our neat gadgets, our iPads and our smartphones, the computer, the TV. There's stuff to do all the time. Moreover, staring at a bright screen will cut back on melatonin secretion, which you need to kind of get into that restful state.
You shouldn't be looking at a computer screen or a TV screen right before you go to bed.
Exactly. And yet polls show that almost everyone does. Moreover, yeah. We try and keep ourselves perked up because we live in this go-go culture. In 1987, Starbucks had only 9 outlets, all in Seattle. Now it has 19,000.
Well, David, what is the solution? How can we get enough sleep?
Well, some people turn to pharmaceutical solutions. In fact, the market for sleeping pills is said to be about $9 billion within the next year or so. It's a huge amount of money. The experts say what you want to do is practice something called good sleep hygiene. And it's complicated. You want to Google it and read about it. But basically, watch out for the caffeine, the alcohol, the nicotine before bed. Try to go to bed at the same time every night. Try to get up at the same time every morning. Try to regulate a bit. And then if you're still having trouble, well, there's some other tricks too that you can read up on.
Get some sleep, David.
I need a latte.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The people who put together the SAT and ACT college entrance exams have announced new security standards in response to a cheating scandal. In New York State last year, students were accused of paying stand-ins to take tests on their behalf. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
Starting next school year, students taking the SAT or ACT will have to provide a headshot in advance. On test day, proctors will check to make sure the person showing up to take the test matches the photo. ACT spokesman Scott Gomer says officials will also send the picture to the student's high school along with their test scores.
The high school teachers and counselors are the ones that know the students best. They'll be able to determine whether or not that's the student who took the test.
Barmak Nasirian represents college admissions officers. He says colleges rely on these tests not only to admit students, but also to dole out financial aid.
And you cannot have gaping holes in test security and continue to be a central element of those transactions.
The tighter security won't raise prices. Students pay $34 to take the basic ACT. The SAT costs $49. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Los Angeles Dodgers have a new owner. The troubled franchise will be bought up by a group of investors, Magic Johnson among them. And Johnson joins a growing list of celebrities investing in sports teams. But does it pay off for them?
Here to talk with us about this for our Midday Extra is Eric Fisher of Sports Business Journal. He's with us now. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
Well, first and foremost, is this a good investment for these people like Magic Johnson who went in on the Dodgers?
Absolutely. You're talking about one of the iconic franchises in baseball with a team that has the economic potential to essentially be the Yankees of the West. There's all sorts of things that can be done at the stadium with the surrounding land, but most importantly, they have the promise of a massive new local cable TV deal coming in 2 years that's essentially going to bankroll a lot of what's happening here.
If you don't mind breaking this down for us a little bit, where does the money come from when you buy a team like the Dodgers? How do you make money?
the team in and of itself, between the tickets are the largest individual revenue source, and then the local cable TV rights fees, local sponsorships, and then there are also a passel of national revenues that they share in, like the other 29 MLB teams, where they'll get a cut of national merchandise sales, national sponsorships, national media, and so forth.
Now, this morning, as we've been reporting this story on the air, I've been just saying Magic Johnson's name. Now, I know there's a whole group of other people that are associated with this purchase, but I'm just saying his name. What does the fact that there's a celebrity behind this, somebody that really everybody knows, how does that change the dynamic here?
Well, you know, most owners don't become sort of known public figures until they actually buy a team. And before they ever buy their sports teams, they're essentially private businessmen. Magic's a different situation, obviously, that you've had somebody who, you know, is a basketball legend. But the thing with interesting about Magic is that he's not the typical celebrity here, that ever since he stopped playing and stopped coaching, he's transitioned into this phenomenally successful business career. And for much of the past 20 years, he's been a very successful businessman and philanthropist in his own right.
We mentioned earlier that celebrities are purchasing teams more and more like this. What kind of advice would you give to a celebrity looking to buy a team? What kinds of teams tend to be profitable, and what makes them a good investment or a bad investment?
My point about Magic holds that he's obviously got a lot more business experience than some other celebrities who bought into sports teams. But the common thread, at least in the successful ventures, even in a situation like Magic, is to surround yourself with experienced and good people. So he's got Stan Kasten coming in as one of his lead partners, and he's been running professional sports teams for more than 30 years and knows how the business works inside and out. And he's actually going to be running the day-to-day operations of the team. And you got a guy like Peter Guber, who runs a series of successful minor league teams, owns a stake in the Golden State Warriors, also has a great deal of experience. And then there are all sorts of other partners who know all sorts of things about how the sports industry works. So the key point is to not just go in blind and just trade on your name. This is still a real business that needs real care and attention on a daily basis. And if you surround yourself with good, qualified, experienced people, successful things can happen.
Eric, last year I went to go see a Dodgers game at Dodger Stadium, and I remember my favorite statistic from the game was they come up on the big screen about halfway through the game and say it's been since something like 1975 since the game has been rained out at Dodger Stadium. Not a lot of rain here in L.A.
Stop rubbing it in, Jeremy.
Although you always end up with a sunburn after going to one of the games. Eric Fisher of Sports Business Journal, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Have a great day.
Well, Stacey, you know, we mentioned it was $2 billion that they spent on the Dodgers,
right,
there.
Right.
And I just took a look to see what else these guys could have bought for $2 billion. And I found that they could have bought season tickets to see the Dodgers for the next 308,000 years.
Wow, that's a lot of games.
That would be a lot of games. Or they could also have bought 444 million Dodger dogs, those hot dogs they give you at Dodger Stadium.
Oh, those are great. I miss those.
And I'm guessing that if you buy that many, they'll probably give you as many ketchup packets as you want to put on them.
You'd hope.
Maybe.
You'd hope.
Maybe not. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.